Hello and welcome to episode 135 of Africa Past and Present, the podcast about African history, culture, and politics. I'm your host, Peter Alleggi. My guest today is Michelle Sykes. Dr. Sykes is an assistant professor of kinesiology, African studies, and history at Pennsylvania State University. She's a graduate of Wake Forest University and earned her doctorate at the University of Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar. She has taught at the University of Cape Town and Stellenbosch University in South Africa and is author of the new book, Kenya's Running Women, A History, published by Michigan State University Press in 2023. She's also the co-editor of three books, Women's Sport in Africa, 2015 with Routledge, The Politics of Historical Memory and Commemoration in Africa, De Gruyter, 2022, and Sport and Apartheid South Africa, Histories of Politics, Power, and Protest, 2022 with Routledge. Dr. Sykes is also a former professional runner sponsored by a big-time company and won an NCAA Division I national championship in the 5,000 meters event. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Peter. It's such a pleasure to be here. I am really grateful for the opportunity to be part of the Africa Past and Present podcast.
Many people don't know that before you became an academic, you were an elite runner. You were an NCAA champion. The YouTube video is available, 2007. Maybe we can listen to a clip. And then a professional athlete competing in the precursor to what today is called the Diamond League, a circuit of the world's best athletic meets. Can you tell us a little bit about your extraordinary journey from the track to academia?
Absolutely. Thank you, Peter, for this wonderful introduction and giving me the chance to share a little bit about my journey to speaking with you all today. And it all starts in Cleveland, Ohio, which is where I am from and was raised, grew up. And I started running seriously in high school. I played basketball and soccer as well as a kid, but I started running track and cross country in high school. And then I moved, I was able to win a few state championships along the way. And I was lucky enough to be able to get an athletic scholarship to Wake Forest University, where I also competed in both in indoor and outdoor track and cross country. And I was coached by what was then a rarity and still remains, a woman by the name of Annie Bennett. And she recruited me out of high school. And she's pretty special because she was one of the very few women to be a head coach of both the men's and women's track programs at Wake Forest. And she was also the head coach of the cross country program. And so there's something like 2% of college, it's been in the last 20 years, it ranges between 2 and 5% of men's sports that are coached by women coaches. Only a very, very minuscule proportion are coached by women. So she was just a very strong personality, an incredible role model. And she herself actually won an NCAA title in the women's 5,000 meters in 1985. So about, you know, a few decades before I competed, but it was a real, when I then in my final race of my senior year in college at Wake Forest, I was competing in the women's 5,000 meters race. And it was a battle between me and another woman who I'll talk about in a second, but just to explain the connection with my coach at the time, I ended up winning that race. And so it was really special for her and for both of us. And so, yeah, having a strong female role model throughout those years was something that I think I really benefited from. But that race was also very pivotal in the writing of the book that we'll go on to talk about, Kenya's Running Women, A History, because I was competing against a woman named Sally Kipyego. And she, in that era, was the dominant athlete in the United States in women's long distance running at the collegiate level. She had won the NCAA cross country title that year. She'd won the indoor 3,000 and indoor 5,000 meter titles. And at the outdoor track meet, the final big event for the collegiate season, she was entered in both the women's 10,000 meters and 5,000 meters. And she competed in the 10,000 first, and she won that race. And so the women's 5,000 meters was the final event for her for that year, and one of the last events in the meet. And my coach and I watched her race the 10K a few nights before the 5K final. And she had a really interesting strategy, which was to take the lead and then try to slow it down. And because everybody at the time knew what a great runner she was, everyone allowed her to really dictate the pace in the 10K. And so if anyone tried to pass, she would quickly get ahead of them, take the lead for a little while, and just try to slow the pace down. And then eventually she was able to come away with the victory in a final spurt at the end of the 10K. So for me, I was an athlete who really benefits from a hard pace throughout. I don't have a great final accelerating sprint. I'm much more of a, I can tolerate pain for a long time. And so if I had any chance of winning a national title, it had to be an honest race. And that's why my coach's advice to me going into the 5K was, look, Michelle, hope that it goes out hard in the first 2K. And after that, with 3K to go, you just got to keep taking the lead. And then if she tries to pass you, you've got to pass her back and try to take the lead again and just try to keep hammering. And pretty much that's what happened in that race. There was a hard start. I got very lucky with somebody else doing the work for the first 2K of the race. And then there was a breakaway pack with myself, Sally Kipiego, another woman. And it then faded to just becoming Sally and I at the front of the race.
Michelle Sykes, senior from Wake Forest, matching up with Sally Kipiego, the sophomore from Texas Tech.
Sally did indeed try to follow her strategy from the 10K, in which she tried to take the lead from me and then slow the pace down. And when she did that, I had my coach's voice in my head, and I went around her and took the lead back and kept pushing the pace.
Enough. It looks like Kipiego may not have a response to the last time that Michelle Sykes has passed her.
Sally Kipiego was trying to make history, looking for a clean sweep, but right now it is Michelle Sykes who wants to run her own story.
I went back and forth like this for a few laps of that 5,000 meter race, and then with about 450 meters to go, it was on the final home straight with one lap still remaining, I passed her.
Michelle Sykes, Rhodes Scholar from Wake Forest.
And made a decisive move around her just with a lap to go. And as I'm coming around the bend on the back straight now, I look behind me and I can see that there's daylight. Suddenly she's no longer there. And I have goosebumps. I still have them now. I'm coming in with 250 meters to go, and I can sense that I've broken her. I'm going to win a national title. And amazingly, magically, miraculously, that happened. I then came through the home stretch and had gapped her, and it was my only national title as a collegiate athlete. And to this day remains my all-time best experience in sport. There's no more euphoric moment for me than that race, because it was such a good race. It was so hard fought, and I ran faster by about 30 seconds than I'd ever run in the 5K. I set an NCAA meet record time at the time in doing so, which means that no one had run faster at an NCAA women's outdoor track and field championship meet.
Takes the title in the women's 5,000 meters, best time this year, 15:16.75, and it's a new meet record.
It's truly a testament to how good Sally Kipiego was, and what she drew out of me in order to make that title a reality. So all that is then very much part of my story when it comes to writing this book, Kenya's Running Women History, because when I had the opportunity after I graduated from Wake Forest to go to Oxford University and continue my graduate studies there, I had not traveled abroad in any way before doing that because I had always been an athlete and you didn't get a chance, especially a track and field athlete, you're competing year round. So I never left, got the chance to really study elsewhere. And also Oxford, of course, is a very prestigious university. And so when I arrived there, I was intimidated a bit. And so the kind of what compelled me then while I was there to pick a I had to pick a topic to study for my master's and my PhD work. And all those forces kind of guided me to the idea that, you know what, I think I want to study Kenyan women's distance running. And in particular, I want to study their history and I want to study and get at the women who paved the way for the Sally Kipyegos of today and all the women who've come after her in the years since, because I looked around at what had been written in the sport world that at that point, and it really focused on what Kenyan men had achieved. And that was remarkable. Kenyan men have amazing, remarkable, extraordinary stories that warrant that attention. But there was this omission when it came to the equivalent first generation of women from Kenya who competed internationally at Olympic Games, at the Commonwealth Games. And so my PhD became a history of women's distance running. And in particular, I was out to find those individual athletes who were at the forefront of the international move by Kenyan women in running. So I should maybe stop there, and but hopefully that gives you a sense of my background and kind of what has drawn me to the project that we'll
talk
about.
That's an extraordinary journey that you're still on. And it was a real pleasure, a genuine pleasure to work with you on the book. Full disclosure, the book was published in the series that I edit at the MSU Press, African History and Culture. And, you know, I've known you, Michelle, for some years, but I've also really appreciated the way in which this dissertation has evolved over the years. You've really taken great care at working away at some of the weaknesses that every doctoral dissertation, of course, has, because you're writing for, you know, just a few people, your committee, and writing a book is a very different enterprise. The audience, hopefully, is much broader than four or five people and your parents. And you really did a remarkable job listening and trying to build on your experience in the field. And, you know, even your thesis itself in the book got refined over time. And so I think it would be fascinating for the listeners to listen to you describe concisely, you know, what the main argument of the book is, and particularly how sport relates to Kenyan society as a whole. Like, for example, how did these women runners foster a kind of shared understanding of Kenyan-ness, sometimes of community pride, even just at the local level. And of course, your very important focus on women's empowerment. How did they do this over time?
Gosh, Peter, thank you. That's a great question. And I guess I would say that, you know, today, since about the early 2000s, the world has become accustomed to seeing Kenyan women medal at major championships. We are used to seeing Kenyan men and women sweep marathon victories, claim world records. But little is known about that pioneer generation of women's distance running who paved the way for Kenya's reputation as this international powerhouse in women's track and field. So the book is an effort to detail the challenges and the triumphs that these women faced from the very start of Kenya's track and field program, which was in the colonial era, and through the professionalization of running in the 1980s and 1990s. And the main argument of the book is that running becomes this vehicle for Kenyan women to expand the boundaries of acceptable female behavior. And it also, I think, and I hope, shows the necessity of including women in histories of African sport and of incorporating sport into studies of African gender and more broadly.
One of the great challenges that you faced is the paucity of sources. It's very difficult to go into an archive, whether it's in Kenya or the United States or elsewhere, and find in institutional collections and repositories plenty of detail on the competitions and lives and afterlives of women athletes, particularly, you know, in the colonial period and then into the first couple of decades of independence. And, you know, that, there's a point here about the near absence of women in many history books, including African history books, including textbooks on African history that often don't talk about women or neglect them, marginalize them. And when they're present there, it's a very narrow portrait. They're almost passive in the broader script of history. And oftentimes when authors, frequently male authors, are confronted with this very loud silence, if you will, the answer is, well, there's few sources. There's almost no sources. But you, I think, in this book and in your work overall, really show how you can be creative and enterprising, not just reading against the grain and through the silences, but digging into corners where there are sources, in fact. You worked a lot with newspapers and magazines, for example, and you conducted also oral history interviews. So can you share with us some reflections on your sources and methodology that allowed you to write this remarkable book?
Absolutely. Yeah, thanks. I'd love to talk about this. And you're absolutely right that there is no single archive of Kenyan or of Kenyan women's sport, much less Kenyan Kenyan women's running history, which is the most famous sport internationally in Kenya. So even that being the case, there isn't an easy archive that one can access. So it's a matter of triangulating across different sets of materials. And as you say, the newspapers and magazines were extremely helpful for helping me to plot out the key narratives that that inform much of the book, just giving details from that time and a sense of the timeline. But they also are helpful because there's quotations at times, fairly not very frequently, but enough of female athletes themselves. And I really, really seized those whenever I could, because it was a rare documented in the moment opportunity to hear from the women at the time they were experiencing sport. And so I would argue that sport is a really, I think, still underexamined avenue for scholars of gender and of women's history to get at some of these past stories of remarkable women, because of how the sporting press, particularly in English language countries like Kenya, has left behind a really strong archive that actually includes direct lines to what women of the day were experiencing that you can't necessarily find across different realms of human endeavor. So those were newspapers and magazines as well in Kenya. I think I'm really lucky because Kenya has such a rich print culture, and I found one of the ways I changed the book from what the dissertation was is in the years since I finished the dissertation, I was able to find a series of magazines that aren't related to sport that I didn't consider looking at when I was a grad student. And those were women's magazines, and they featured profiles of top female athletes in Kenya at the time, really helpful. And there were other broader sport focused magazines that I tapped into, which I hadn't known about as a grad student. And those definitely male athletic stories were the dominant focus, but at times they did feature women and what was going on with women's running. So, you know, There's material out there. It just takes time and patience to figure out where it is and how to access it. Then, of course, the archival record, I looked into it, and it was really excellent in terms of how institutions work, especially in the British colonial years, as they left very detailed records. Unfortunately, frustratingly little about women, but that was because the British themselves were not very concerned to develop women's athletics as they were the men's side. And going further back in time, I tapped into ethnographies that were written at sort of the turn of the 20th century and through the early decades of the 20th century. And there, what I did was I tried to look for how the authors were describing movement cultures and noting who was doing what in terms of the gendered perspective, and was able to get a sense of what men and women were doing physically and who was doing long distance running or traveling or who was working at home, and really zeroing in on just the basic question of where are the women and what are they doing. And so that helped me to get at kind of what life might have been like prior to the British arriving in terms of endurance activities. So those were some of the essential sources that I conducted or that I was seeking in the course of writing the book. But of course, the essential source without which the book wouldn't have been possible were the athlete interviews, the coach interviews, the interviews with people around the sport. And it helped at the time that as I was a graduate student, I was still running at a high level. And my agent, I had, as you mentioned, I ran for a prominent company, and I had a manager who had connections on the ground in Kenya, and that really, really helped me to access that network of top-level runners. And the my friend Godfrey Kipritich is somebody who I'll be forever grateful to, because he was the one who himself actually was a very top-level pacemaker for some of the records set in the 90s. And so he knew very well the women who had come before him, and he was able to facilitate conversations with them that I would not have, that are central to understanding the history of Kenyan women's running. And so staying in E10, which is seen as the mecca of distance running, maybe people who are focused on Ethiopia might argue elsewhere, but I would say it is one of the hubs in the world for distance runners. As you enter the town, it has a big sign over the road saying, "Welcome to E10, home of champions." And so living there for several months and running, training myself, getting out there each day, I think all of that really helped to develop the source material that is at the heart of the book.
That's fabulous. So you became a kind of insider of sorts in the world of elite running. And there's something to be learned there about how does one from the global north, a white person, come into this remarkable world center of elite running and start asking questions and start conversing and reconstructing people's past. There's a lot of trust that needs to be developed. There's a level of legitimacy too that I think you running alongside these champion runners really displayed for everyone, right? And I think I remember you telling me that you were able to show the video of you winning that 2007 NCAA title, beating the wonderful Kenyan champion, and that really got you places. Then people knew you were very serious. One thing is to be a Rhodes Scholar, another thing is to be one of ours, right? And this also reminds me of another technique that you use in the book that I think you developed really nicely over time. As you transition from the dissertation to the book manuscript, and that is the biographical stories that serve as your narrative hooks in the book. Can you give us a couple of examples of the stories and how they helped you craft maybe a more accurate and lively narrative of African women as agents of their own history, and in this particular case, of course, sporting history and running history?
Oh, Absolutely. Yeah, that's a great question, and I'd love to, because those were some of the most fun parts of the book to write. The getting in, sharing a story, sharing a life story is, and especially the women who I was able to speak with have such incredibly rich and remarkable lives. And I would caveat that by saying that at the same time, that does mean that a focus of my book tends to fall on the women who were successful in competing internationally and doing all sorts of path-breaking things. And so, I would say there's a need for for further research on women who might have competed at more of a mid-level, or who didn't, who attempted to break through beyond Kenya, but were unable to do so during these years. And indeed today, there's always a kind of focus on the top-level athletes, but the grassroots and is also very, very, very important. So that being said, one of the most I would one of my favorite stories comes from an interview and time spent with a woman named Ruth Waithira. And she was the first woman from Kenya to compete in a final at an Olympic Games. And for anyone out there listening, I would like you to take a second and in your mind, guess what year that took place. Try to think about, what we think about Kenyan women today, routinely women winning medals. In what year did a Kenyan woman first qualify for an Olympic final? Okay. The answer is 1984 in LA. So it's not until 1984 that a woman qualifies for a final in the Olympic Games, whereas Kenyan men first debut at the Olympic Games in 1956. They win their first medal in the 800 meters in 1964. And of course, they have this big explosion of medals in Mexico City in 1968, which heralds the kind of onset of the Kenyan men's women running phenomenon. Whereas the women only win their first medal in 1996, and that's in the women's 5K. And they don't win their first gold medal until as late as 2008 in the women's 800 meters. So back to 1984. So it was a really big deal in 84 for a Kenyan woman to qualify for the finals. And that was in the women's 400 meters. Ruth did this. And how she got there is just the most incredible story. She was raised by her mom. Her father passed away when she was a girl, and she had four sisters around her who all were good in sport and competed, but they were quickly married, and she remained the only one at home with her mom. She had a child when she was in her teens, and she was able, though, to get afford school up until that point. And so that's when she found her love for sport and for running, was as a girl in school competing in sports days. And so she stayed with her mom. Her mom took care of her child. And when the opportunity came in her late teens, early 20s, she joined the army as the first woman to do so. And this was a common route for men to join the army as runners and represent that institution in the various competitions within Kenya that the institutions and other parastatals entered teams. But for a woman in the army to do so was unheard of, or that this was unprecedented. So she becomes the first woman to represent the armed forces. And she's a sprinter. 100 meters, 200 meters, 400 meters were her specialties. And by about three years of building up her capacities as a runner again, she was starting to really excel and won four straight golds at the East African Games. And traveled to Russia as a part of a Kenyan contingent to compete over there, and she makes a name for herself as a soldier in the Kenyan army and as a runner. And Then this is around the time that Title IX in the United States is finally becoming an enforced law. And there are institutions and universities here that are looking for top athletes, not just on the men's side, as they had historically done, but also for women. And so she is able to get an athletic scholarship at the University of Arizona. She comes over to compete here in the United States, and she wins an NCAA title. And in her senior year at Arizona State, she's also able to qualify for the Olympic Games. She's already based in the US, joins the Kenyan team when they come over, and the rest is history. That's when she is able to qualify, make it all the way to the finals, and become the first Kenyan woman to do that. So it's just so many unprecedented, so many firsts in her life alone.
That's a great example of the transnational dimensions that you bring out in the book. This is not just about Kenya and central Kenya in particular, or Iten. It's a Kenya that's globalizing in numerous different ways, and the growing participation and success and representation of women on the world athletic scene is really embedded in your narrative. Title IX in the United States in the 1970s and 80s transforms the landscape for Kenyan women. This is not a connection that's often made by historians or scholars of sport, and it is a very important one. You also point out that athletics themselves were evolving very, very quickly, beginning in the late 80s, early 90s. You get the sort of commercial revolution with athletics going professional. I know it's hard for the kids these days to think about, world champions and Olympic champions being amateurs, legally amateurs, well into the 1980s, but that was the case. And so when big time money comes into the game, into the sport, Kenyan women are perfectly positioned to try and take advantage of this opportunity. How did Kenyan women then leap at the possibility of competing internationally during the professional era, and what happened to those who made lots of money from their success?
That, Peter, you have asked a really good, brilliant question. And if I could maybe before, yeah, to help to answer it, I think I would like to put this into historical perspective of just how remarkable it is for athletes in general to be able to start to earn money in the late 80s and early 90s. But at the same time, importantly, how remarkable it is for women to be able to compete over long distances, which doesn't take shape properly at the if we look at the Olympics for now in isolation until the 1980s, which is, I think, just again, from the vantage point of 2024, a really startling reminder of the progress that was made within women's track and field over the course of the 20th century, but also the challenges that that posed for women who did not have benefit from the same opportunities that women do today in sport. And so if you go back as far as 1968, that year when Kenyan men win medals in every single long distance event at the track at the Olympic Games, the longest distance that women could compete in 1968 was the 800 meters. It was all for all women all around the world. Two laps was the longest distance for women. You fast forward to 1972, and the IOC has added one more event to women's track, and that's the 1500 meters. So at this point, the longest distance any woman can compete in is the 1500 meters. It's not until 1984 that the women's marathon is added and the women's 3K, which then gets changed to the 5K later. And it's not till 1988 that the 10K is added. So finally, in the 80s, that's really the moment when we see much greater, there finally being equal opportunities between men and women at the law in the long distance events at the international level. And everything follows what the Olympics do. And so because the Olympics added these events, so too do nations add these events to their national championships, the Commonwealth Games, for instance, similar. So at the same time as women can start competing in longer distance events and winning medals, this is also when the sport of track and field, which had historically been a really adamant, staunch defender of amateurism and prohibiting athletes from receiving any monetary benefit for their sporting endeavors, slowly, inch by inch, incrementally segues into a livelihood strategy where people can begin to be remunerated for their athleticism. And it doesn't happen overnight, just like the most like women's events were not added to Olympic program overnight. They start off with a program where athletes could earn money that was then put into trust funds that athletes could then access after their careers, for instance. But by the 90s, things start to kind of explode, and there are prize money winnings attached to the major track and field events in Europe. And there's also a lot of new competitions that start to mushroom up because of kind of the money that was now going to be available within the sport, and television programs that were interested in putting the track and field before viewers. And so lots of money came through sponsorship of the media rights to these events. So we start to see a world championships take off in track and field, world championships for cross country, and a variety of just new races and road races all around the world. And as you just said a second ago, Peter, now with the coming together of women's long distance running and commercialization of sport, that makes Kenyan women really, really well suited to step into these new opportunities and start to flourish. And here, a woman who I talk about in my book, Teglu LaRoup, was one of the leaders. She was born in a place called West Pokote in the Great Rift Valley, where Iten is as well. And she had all, like Ruth Athira, she had always loved competing as a girl, and did well as a young person. And it was in 1994 that she ran and won her first major marathon in New York City. And that was really pivotal. That was one of the first times a woman had won a major marathon. And she just, I think, became a role model for so many people who then followed her. And she was right there at that exact right time, incredibly talented athlete, really fierce, driven, and just took advantage of these opportunities. And so when she came home, what she did is she followed a template that really a lot of her male counterparts had already established and were establishing around her, which was to look after her kin, her family, large extended family. But beyond that, she also started a local road race in her home area to try to bring peace to warring groups around her. She's founded a school. She's been an ambassador for peace around the world. She's just, you know, a pretty amazing figure in so many ways. So this is some of the change that sport has allowed women and Kenyans generally to have.
And in any patriarchal society, when women become successful, when they gain social honor, when they become rich in certain extraordinary cases, or simply well enough to be autonomous from men, this generates conflict. Not always, but it often does. And there was a New Yorker article in 2023 that put an uncomfortable spotlight on the assaults taking place on female runners, particularly champion runners in Kenya. And it was really shocking to see the kind of abuse that is sometimes thrust upon these champions. And in at least a couple of cases, that of Agnes Tirop and Edith Mutoni, they were actually killed, most likely by their partners. You know, this really shows that the success of Kenyan women runners is not something that is universally celebrated, or that its consequences are, you know, unequivocally positive. Did you feel when you were in Kenya, when and in your research and in your experience, did you feel that this was a phenomenon that was lurking in the background that was a source of stress and anxiety and concern among the women you were close to?
Thanks, Peter. It's really, really well said. And I did indeed feel it. And it was because I was primarily focused on interviewing the women from the earlier generations and the women who actually initially, many of them competed predominantly during the amateur era. And their careers were ending when the money starts to really arrive within the sport. And so as I spoke with them, a common refrain that emerged was how different running is today from what it was during their era, and how the money has changed everything, and how they sort of lament the motivation for becoming an athlete amongst the runners of today, the women, young girls of today, being the pursuit of financial security and as opposed to the sorts of motivations that drove them into the sport, which were desire to see new places, to get further their education, to represent Kenya as a nation, to win gold at the Olympics. And these, of course, are important to women today still, but there is now this new dynamic that one can earn a lot of money if you can become really successful in running. And women from Kenya have actually had, in some ways, an advantage in that regard compared to men, because men run around the world and compete in track and field, is all sports. And because we have patriarchal societies in many parts of the world, there are fewer women in many cases may have fewer chances to emerge in sport as a general rule compared to men. And so for Kenyan women who are able to make it out and compete at the international level, they can often have an easier time of doing that than perhaps their husband or their brother or their male counterparts will. And so it leads to this dynamic where male figures in Kenyan women's lives recognize that too. And the Kenyan woman becomes the breadwinner for the family. And the interpersonal, intra-household dynamics that can create are complicated. And so there was definitely a sense that the arrival of money, of fortunes that could be earned through sport, was not by any means a wholesale good in Kenyan women's lives. This is coming from the older generation.
Now, you've trained with and competed against Kenyan runners, as well as studied them as a professional historian and told these extraordinary stories. I'm going to pose a question that you're going to answer beautifully, I'm sure, and resolve all of the controversy that has surrounded this for years and years and years. What makes them so great?
Oh, that question. Thank you, Peter. Oh, that is a question that I, from the outset of my research, tried to avoid because I sort of took that as for granted that Kenyan and East African runners are great. And my effort was to use sport to understand gender dynamics in over the course of time and how that changed within a particular Kenyan society. But to your question, I do think that the various environmental benefits, advantages that come from the lifestyle that one can find in around the Rift Valley is remarkable. I mean, I say this as a runner myself and someone who grew up at sea level in Cleveland, to then be transported to 8,000 feet in E10. It was my first time ever at altitude, and to experience just the how incredibly more difficult it becomes to do even a simple low-key run at that level, even once you're adjusted to it. I mean, the benefits are just enormous of altitude alone. And then you add to that the miles and miles of beautiful trails and just nourishing spaces where you can train. You add to that this community feel where at any time time of day, but certainly at the three main times when people tend to gather for a run, you can find somebody to run with and be motivated by that feeling that you're out there with somebody else doing this hard thing. And of course, all the fantastic foods that are healthy and keep your body running as best it can. I mean, there's to parse any of those different variables and say it was this one thing would be impossible, but certainly the collection of all of that really, really helps.
Very nicely put. And I want to close with something unrelated to Kenya. You've done a lot of additional work in sport history and politics, particularly around anti-apartheid politics, rebel tours, and you also looked at sport and racism in the U.S. And I'm frequently torn when studying and teaching about sport in Africa and beyond on the issue of whether it is a force for empowerment or disempowerment. There are days when I wake up and I smile and I say, I'm so glad I'm doing sports because this is the most enthralling and empowering force in human society. And then, you know, a few days later, I'll wake up and say, oh my goodness, sports are the source of every evil in the world or nearly every evil in the world. And so looking at your and drawing on the work that you've done on sports and politics in relation to Africa in particular, how would you characterize sports' place within this kind of global quest for Black freedom, equality, and justice?
What a question, Peter. That's brilliant. So there, I think I will have to draw on work I've done looking outside the Kenyan women runner space in particular, and more at the focus on South Africa and the anti-apartheid movement and the international boycott that was implemented to try to combat apartheid in South Africa. And I would say that it makes a difference. Like, I want to be the Pollyanna for a moment, if I can. And I think that that case alone, like we can say many, many times that sport hasn't been a force for good, and we can find reasons to criticize how sport is run, who's been involved in it, the lack of opportunities for women historically for various different constituents. But it can be added to a menu of political levers that if people choose and if there's a coalition that agrees, that can make create a forum for conversation and for action that we as socially committed people shouldn't ignore. And here I really am thinking about some of the anti-apartheid activism that took place in the United Kingdom around rugby matches, or in New Zealand when the Springboks came to play and the country erupted in the biggest anti-apartheid response that it had ever had and would have again. And I just think that without the international glory and international spotlight that comes with sport, it creates a chance for as you asked about the global quest for Black freedom, equality, and justice, it's a space in which that has been advanced. So I'm going to stand with the let's wake up in the morning and see it as the glass half full.
And that's a wonderful way to bring our conversation to a close. Dr. Michelle Sykes, the author of the new book, Kenya's Running Women, A History, published by our very own Michigan State University Press. Thanks so much for speaking with Africa Past and Present.
Thank you so much, Peter. It's been such a pleasure.
Africa Past and Present is a team effort of Matrix, the Center for Digital Humanities and Social Sciences, the African Studies Center, and the Department of History at Michigan State University. You can listen to and search through all past episodes on our website, afropod.aodl.org. Please subscribe on Apple Podcasts and other platforms, where you can also like us and leave a comment. That really helps. We encourage you to use and share this podcast under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial 4.0 International License. And to get in touch, send email to Allegi, A-L-E-G-I, at msu.edu. Thanks for listening.